You're listening to The Daily Digestionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
This is your host of The Daily Traditionalist, Matthew Heimbach, and I'm here today to close out the week with a very special guest. I am so excited about this. A man that many of you, if you don't know already, you should know. I'm joined by Mr. Florian Geyer, host of Mysterium Feshies. You can listen to his show on Radio Arian and The Daily Stormer. But he's joining me today to talk about a topic that I think is really important, about the role of Christianity within fascism. So, Florian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing really fantastic. It's a very bright, sunny day up in Canada, and it's, you know, always an honor and a pleasure to come on and to join you. You know, thank you very much.
Well, I really appreciate you being here. Let's just start out for the uninitiated. Give us your testimony, you know, Baptist style. Give me your give our listeners a little bit about you, just to introduce yourself and tell them a little bit about your show.
Well, let's see. I was red pilled through Pol and the 4chan culture, and I kind of came into the alt right through neo-reaction and that whole scene, and one thing led to another, and after hooking up with Zeiger of Iron March and Daily Stormer, he kind of red-pilled me on fascism and national socialism from neo-reaction. So I moved in this direction. Some of your listeners probably know I'm still pursuing and discerning a vocation to the priesthood, and I was as a Roman Catholic, and recently I converted to Orthodoxy. And so that's where I am in my life right now in, you know, 45 seconds, 30 seconds.
There you go. I love it. Well, you know, it's something I think is really interesting. And we talked about it when I was on your show, actually, but a little bit about our similar journeys. You know, I was raised as a Catholic, and I actually looked into the priesthood. My wife is really happy. I was meeting with a traditionalist priest, you know, discerning my vocation. And I started walking towards Orthodoxy as we were dating. And it was a really tragic thing. We thought we might have to break up if I joined the Catholic priesthood, but then it became Orthodox. That didn't become an issue. But, you know, it's interesting the journey that so many really young nationalists have walked, because, you know, we really search for truth. And I think in this age where we're told that there is no truth, you really want to find truth. And that's led us to look towards faith. And faith is such a powerful foundation for everything you do in the world. And, you know, many of us who were raised Catholic look through the Catholic Church and see the failures of Rome and see the failures of the post-Vatican II Church and, of course, before, and make this move towards Orthodoxy. So, what really brought you, from Catholicism to Orthodoxy?
I had a full-blown conversion experience, so it really wasn't like an intellectual or political decision. I was, you know, very blessed that it was something, you know, very intimate and spiritual, which happened to me completely out of the blue. And so I, in a sense, didn't really make that decision. It's something that happened to me. And then after this experience occurred, you know, then I started looking deeper into the theological differences, into the historical differences, into all of these things.
Well, and it's a very powerful thing, you know, again, to have a connection with God and to really understand that what we're doing, you know, we're not just battling against, you know, physical bodies. We're battling against principalities and powers. And one of the things that gets me is some of my friends who, you know, are agnostic or atheists and stuff. They go like, I can't understand the Jews. I can't understand the Jews. Why are they so evil? And I say, like, look, I'm not. You know, I have no problem telling people about my faith. I love to do it, actually. But I don't try and bash it down people's throats. I say, these people and what's going on in the modern world only makes sense to me personally in a spiritual lens, because our enemies are truly evil. Sven and I were actually on the show yesterday talking about it, that they are just driven by hatred of everything that is good, whether it's the family or whether it's the unborn. I mean, taking the womb, which is supposed to be where life comes from, and the woman as the nurturer and the mother, and turning her into a murderer, and turning the womb into a graveyard. I mean, just things like that is the total inversion. It's like a black mass is the opposite of what we do in the liturgy. Everything about the modern left and everything about this progressive system is evil and satanic and is the opposite of what is good. So for you, have you kind of had a similar experience that the only way we can understand whether it's the Jews, whether it's leftists, whether it's globalists, everything they're trying to do, I mean, in my mind, it's just a satanic power.
I actually agree with you 100%. And the way that you've defined satanic there is exactly the way I use it. It's a complete inversion of the natural or the cosmic order. And that's the way I use it in a technical term. And I always try to reinforce with my listeners, when we say satanic, we're not being hyperbolic, we're not exaggerating, we're being very precise. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you 100%. You know, we're not, our physical enemies are manifestations of spiritual evil. And I kind of came into the alt-right and just to right-wing politics through like libertarianism and Alex Jones and stuff like that, you know, conspiracy type stuff. And to quote, our friend, Father Raphael Johnson, if it doesn't make sense, it's not true. And the only consolidating narrative I've ever found that is able to kind of reconcile, you know, this grand conspiracy that we see unfold across history is the spiritual warfare, is the theology of the Orthodox Church. That indeed our enemies are not in physical backrooms, but in spiritual backrooms, conspiring on the spiritual realm or working for entities that do it for them.
Well, and that for me, you know, when I was in college, it really was eye-opening, wherein, you know, I was actually a Zionist. You know, I was raised as a Zionist. My family were post-Vatican II Catholics, no real strong theology there, and I was raised around a lot of Protestants, and everyone there was, you know, was a Christian Zionist. You know, that's kind of the de facto of low church Protestantism. And I just thought that was the position. And then I get to college, and, you know, I'm in Youth for Western Civilization, and we're doing things like a straight pride day in opposition to the radical homosexual events that are happening on campus. We're doing all these sorts of things, opposing the Muslim Student Association, bringing very radical speakers, Wahhabi-backed speakers that had affiliations with Saudi money to campus. And it was weird to me that, you know, no matter what we were protesting, like we protested the Muslim Student Association bringing this speaker, the Jews were out there protesting us. The homosexuals were out there protesting us. And, you know, saying to these people, you know, these Wahhabis, you know, these Saudi-backed, you know, extremists, they want to throw you off a building. What are you doing? You know, these feminists, obviously feminism won't survive if mass immigration happens and these people get their way. Why are you on that side? And the only thing that unified them, and anytime there was opposition to us, was an opposition to the West, which, you know, as Hilaire Belloc said, you know, Europe is the church and the church is Europe. Everything that seemed to unite it was in being in opposition to Christianity, to natural law. And that's where, you know, our comrades who are folk religionists, of which I have many, following natural law is also following the law of God. God created the natural world. He created the harmony, whether it's within the family or the nation or the entire planet. And that's what he created. So if you're working to follow natural law, you're actually following Christian principles. And so that's where there's this unifying thread that everything the enemy believes in, you will have radical feminists with proud slut written on their chest standing next to a radical Wahhabi. And they're unified, even though their ideologies are totally contradictory to one another. What unifies them is the stronger power of hating Christianity and therefore hating God's law, which is natural law.
Yes, of course, 100%. And I think this is something that I get a lot of, the idea that Christianity is somehow opposed to natural law. And I sometimes, you know, I have to laugh and shake my head. And it's like, you know, just have to try to patiently explain to them, Christians believe Jesus Christ is the literal personification of natural and cosmic law, the logos.
Well, exactly. And that's where, you know, getting into the depth where, you know, I found within Orthodoxy, for instance, that the depth of the theology is, it's also so beautifully simple. I mean, it's one of those things you could read big, thick books for your entire life and just scratch the surface, but a child can understand the truth. I mean, it's such a powerful thing that absolutely tells to me the validity of what we believe in. But, you know, our enemies, again, wanting to destroy everything that's good. So something I wanted to talk with you about, and you covered it in your first episode of your show, to a great deal, but there is a myth, and I was actually talking with a friend of mine that runs a National Socialist channel, that he's planning to do a video about the relationship between Christianity and National Socialism, and going against the myths, because I've been told, and I was even told when I was a traditionalist Catholic, as I was, you know, researching National Socialism, and I said, you know, Father, the concordant with the Vatican, when you look at men like Leon Degrelle, how could there be an opposition? Mussolini was loved by the Catholic Church and enacted all these laws against a divorce, putting crucifixes in classrooms and in government buildings, and having this very positive Christian morality. How are you telling me we're at war? It just seems the fact they lost is the reason you're on this other perspective. And they go, oh, well, they hated Christianity. Fascism and National Socialism hate Christianity. And I did all this research, and it became very clear that isn't accurate. So let's dig into that a little bit. And I'm just going to take your first knee jerk on when someone tells you National Socialism / fascism hates Christianity. What do you say to that?
Have you ever heard of Corneliu Codrianu and the Iron Guard of Romania? That's my first response immediately. And if they have, then I, you know, ask them if they're stupid or if they have bad faith. And if they haven't, then I'll tell them immediately, you know, like, look, this is a movement that was 100%, you know, 1488% even orthodox from its core and was almost theocratic in the intensity of its fervor. And I mean, Codrianu said it, you know, many times that really it was orthodoxy manifesting itself rather than fascism with an orthodox flavor. And so that's what I go to immediately. And then, you know, then I can pull out quote after quote after quote of Hitler saying, you know, National Socialism is fundamentally a Christian movement. And those who are opposed to Christianity have no place in our movement, in our ranks. You know, even in the SS, of course, you know, and Himmler is conspicuously the least Christian of all of the hierarchs. You know, non-Christians weren't allowed. And so those are the talking points I go to immediately, and you see this time and time and time again across the, you know, the entire spectrum. You know, whether you get the Francoists in Spain, right, as you say, Mussolini in Italy, you know, Codriano in Romania, National Socialist in Germany, Christianity, the faith, is always the bedrock and the core of their worldview, because they realize that, you know, race is the foundation of a country, but nobody lives in a house with just a foundation, no walls and a roof.
Well, exactly. And that's actually one of the interesting things that really strikes me is people say, well, how can you have non-Christians in your movement? And what we were talking about, you know, earlier is, you know, there were people that were agnostics within, for instance, National Socialist Germany. But again, this idea of natural law is going off a Christian principle. So therefore, even those who weren't Christian were actually working on a Christian framework for what they were doing, that these principles that they were espousing were not at odds with Christianity. And in fact, it was glorifying Christianity. I mean, what did we see in National Socialist Germany? You know, taking the place of the mother and putting it in such this important role, you know, the mother's cross being the highest honor that is equal to the men that served on the battlefield and earned the Iron Cross, and understanding that the family means everything, and this positive morality is such an important thing. And it just goes completely against, you know, I really think it's Protestantism, especially in the West, Low Church Protestantism, that instantly, you know, after the creation of the State of Israel, became Zionist. It was by its very, you know, beginning, and there's a lot of theology that goes into the 18th, 19th centuries, but it manifested itself in being the Zionist movement. They tried to redefine history. I mean, it's even simple things like how many times have people said Hitler took the guns? And you say, well, actually, here's all these laws where Hitler actually made it easier for people to carry guns and for people even younger than 18 to get guns and to carry weapons for self-protection. You know, if he was a dictator, why was he arming his people? Why was he encouraging people to be able to defend themselves? The only people that were stripped of weapons were those that were actively fighting against the country. And those are called traitors. You know, it's a pretty simple thing,
indeed.
But these historical facts don't mean anything. It's like water off a duck's back to these people that have locked in their version of truth, even when the facts contradict them.
Yes, exactly. And I think that you've hit on something really critical and key. You know, as you said, you've got many comrades who are, you know, folk religionists, and I personally, you know, have many good friends of mine who are not Christian, who are folk religionists or esotericists of some sort. And I'm more than willing to stand, you know, blow with them all the way to final victory. But the critical denominator that separates them from everybody else is goodwill. Is goodwill, is that, you know, we want the same thing. We realize, as you say, you know, if we've got 10% difference and 90% similarity, that doesn't mean you're 10% our enemy. And that's what I think it comes down to 100% is, you know, certainly some people think I have a reputation of I hate paganism. I don't hate paganism, right? But there are lots of pagans who, unfortunately, they, you know, they don't come at us in good faith. But those who come in good faith certainly have a place at the table.
Well, exactly. And, you know, it's, you know, Father Raphael, not to, you know, if we invoke him so many times, he'll just pop into the call and,
yes, exactly.
And join us on the podcast. But, you know, where he said that there is no conflict between Christianity and folk religion, because folk religion was a poetic understanding of the natural and supernatural world pre-Christian. It was this way of understanding the forces that have always existed, because, you know, Christ is the Alpha and the Omega. God has always existed and will always exist. There is no beginning and there is no end. So people who, when Christ had not yet come, trying to understand these forces. These forces didn't begin in a nativity 2,000 years ago. They have always existed. So it's a poetic understanding of the forces of the universe and what virtue is and what the path to virtue is, of being honorable and having dedication for your countrymen and for your family and taking care of your children and honoring your ancestors and making a better future for your children. So these principles, we really aren't at odds with one another, because, you know, as he said, there is no such thing as, for instance, a pagan heretic. You know, there is no Nicene or Apostles' Creed in that regard. It's a poetic understanding and a powerful poetic understanding of everything. And if you go into National Socialism, you know, Dietrich Eckart, you know, one of the ideological founders of National Socialism in Germany, you know, of course, said that when you think of Balder, when you think of the traditions of our people, how beautiful is it that our people were already so Christian? This idea of the prefiguration of the coming of Christ and of Christianity in our ancient traditions. So there's no hatred there. There's no animosity there. It's actually a celebration. And it, you know, to me, this is then the fulfillment of my ancestors' belief systems that they find in Christianity. So would you have a similar response to, you know, to pagans that say, well, you're at war with us? Cause to me, I see us as being the fulfillment, but there is no animosity there in my book.
Yes, I agree 100%. And I think a fantastic example of this, and I want to give a shout out to my Frisian and Dutch comrades, is the Aurea Linda book, which was, some people called it Himmler's Bible. And this is purportedly like an ancient Aryan manuscript that survives from just after the, you know, post-Diluvian period, which describes the ancient religion of the Frisians, which was essentially logos worship, the worship of one god. And then we see this all throughout the Aryan myths, is that there's this, it all stems from this one core perennial tradition, this primordial religion that gradually dispersed itself and gained local flavors over time. And so, yes, I agree with you 100%. I don't think that there's really any conflict in terms of, as far as practical operations go. I think that, you know, they are certainly compatible as far as living and struggling with one another. I think we agree on basically all of the precepts of natural law. And I think that, we're going to talk about this a little bit tomorrow, but I despise this infighting that's recently, you know, risen up for various reasons. And I think that our goals always have to be, the key principles in our mind always have to be, how do we stop these kikes and how do we help our people?
Well, it's so true. I mean, fundamentally breaking things down, two things for me, 14 words. Which are pretty simple as to what we're fighting for, and we've got to stop these kikes. These people, yes, are absolutely manifestations of evil, trying to destroy everything we believe in. And, you know, when it comes to the infighting, you know, Andrew England had an article about it, about purity spiraling, and it was so funny. I was actually taking my son this morning. We went to the grocery store, giving my wife a little time to sleep in this morning, and, you know, he loves to go to the store, and we were getting milk and stuff, and I was in the store, and I said, wait a second. Purity spiraling, Dr. Goebbels. And I thought of his an article that he published in 1939, actually, that was called More Morality, Less Moralism. And it was it's an article that talks about within the, within National Socialism, that what we need is more morality and less moralism. Moralism is standing on the soapbox and condemning people and not really living the faith, not really believing in the virtues and things like that. And how what National Socialism is, it's about actually cultivating morality. He uses an example. I'm actually looking at the article now. That there was a soap company that had an advertisement with a lady on it that was slightly sexual, and there was a local NSDAP party member that the quote says, a moral knight who unfortunately had the right to determine the fate of this poster forbade its distribution on the grounds that it offended the moral sensibilities of the population, since the woman on the poster was holding soap in a place that for moral reasons cannot be described more precisely. And it goes on and talks, of course, I believe in having a clean moral space, but Dr. Goebbels discusses in depth the idea of what National Socialism is about this spiritual rebirth. It's not totalitarian insofar as the way we would think of it, of forcing morality on people, of saying this is the rules, because all you're doing then is putting vice and sin into a black market. It's putting it into the darkness where it's able to survive and thrive and grow. But instead, what National Socialism is about cultivating inside the spirit of the people this morality, so that they're going to want to live moral lives. They're going to have those strong family virtues and things like that. And it's the opposite of this purity spiraling we see in this current movement, where people want to tear each other apart, or, you know, we've all made mistakes, myself included, and about getting on the soapbox to say, oh, this is exactly how things should be, when instead I think we should be focusing on cultivating a personal and a movement morality that's going to reject anything that's immoral anyway, and then put out positive things. So I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on that in regards to this infighting, because one of these big things is you know, purity spiraling. It's this moralism, and I really do think Dr. Goebbels was right. We need more morality and less moralism.
Yeah, I agree with you fervently, and so I'm going to preface this by saying that I've always seen our mission fundamentally 100% as the cultivation of virtue. Every single ailment that has befallen our Western civilization has occurred because our ancestors in the past were not virtuous enough to stand up and make their opinions known or to resist the policies that were being implemented. Now, that's not necessary. You know, of course, there are always circumstances and manipulations and, you know, schemy Jewish tricks that go along with, you know, the whole gamut of history. But the long story short is that if we had a virtuous people in the West, feminism would not exist. There would not be abortion. We would have a legitimate government that defend our population from the foreign invading hordes. None of the, we would not even be having this conversation because it would not be necessary if our people were virtuous. And if we are not virtuous, even if we do take power, then we will rapidly descend back to the point that we find ourselves at now. And so I agree with you and Dr. Goebbels 100%. And I think that what it comes down to fundamentally is that we have to agree on the principles and on the goals. If we have the same worldview, if we have the same goals, then we can work together. There can even be a healthy diversity in our movement. But what happens with this purity spiraling, although I don't really like the term, but it seems the most apt in this sense, is that you find this really, like, this polarization even on the far right, to the degree that we see it in the mainstream between conservatives and liberals, where they become like Jungian shadows of one another. You know, and we can even see this in the church where, you know, some guys are so obsessed with like the rigidity and, you know, the canons, you know, they take the canons and they crumble them up and they snort it and get high on it. And then others, you know, they throw it up completely and say, oh, you know, the canons don't matter, the letters of the law don't matter, just kind of do whatever you want. But of course, you know, the way of proceeding is in the middle, right? Where you respect the understanding that the literal manifestations of a spirit are symbols that point us towards the spiritual reality, imperfect ones at that.
Well, exactly. And, you know, example, I'll read this briefly because I think it hits, you know, the discussion you brought up, feminism, is in our movement that there is, you know, people that really kind of bow down, you know, I don't know what other term to use, to thoughts and get really thirsty and chase them.
Yes.
Versus you've got the MRAs that say, oh, we don't need women or things like that. And where the National Socialist perspective and the movement perspective is gender cooperation as we work together. And he writes in this quote, have these moral trumpeters any idea how they slander and demoralize millions of German women with their preaching? Women who bravely and honestly do their duty in life and on the job, who are good comrades to their men and sacrificing mothers for their children. Don't they realize that they embarrass National Socialism throughout the world, that they are 30 years too late, or that one may make them take to task because they're beginning to be annoying? There are good and bad women, decent and less decent women, some with bobbed hair, some without. Whether or not they powder their noses is not a sign of their inner worth. And if they occasionally smoke a cigarette or at home or in society, they do not need to feel rejected or cast out. In any event, these moralists should sit not in judgment over women, whether they are enemies or even if, like all real men, they wish women happiness, relaxation, and domestic peace, though their stuffy superiority would keep women from it. And that's a term I think is really powerful. Stuffy superiority. And it's not just, again, cultivate good values. We need to be totally opposed to radical feminism. But, you know, we should not have a stuffy superiority over women. We should be encouraging positive virtues. And when it comes to men in our movement that might have shortcomings, again, I have plenty. No problem admitting that. When I say, you know, in the liturgy that Christ came in the world to save sinners, of who I am chief, I mean that sincerely. But there seems to be this stuffy superiority where people want to, you know, feel better. They want to showboat. And that's just poison to any sort of unity, any sort of movement, because eventually you'll just be tearing at one another and it's not going to be a positive thing. So for our movement, how do you think we can move past this stuffy superiority that causes nothing but infighting and slander and rumor mongering and division?
One word, charity. And I think that this is the critical element that is lacking in our entire movement, is that we don't have a binding force of charity that allows us to deal with our brothers in good faith. If we were able to extend the benefit of the doubt, if we were able to you know, analyze objectively, and if we found a fault, go to them, you know, in twos or threes and speak to them in, you know, a kind and reasonable manner. I think that we could avoid a huge amount of these problems that we run into. But the problem is that there's no charity. People look at their political, the men who disagree with them on the far right as being, you know, their political adversaries, more so than the kikes in many instances. And rather than, you know, attempting to reform them or bring them back into a more full understanding of, let's say, the worldview, they denigrate and they huff up with a stuffy superiority. So I think that the most important thing is that we need to cultivate a spirit of fraternity, of brotherhood, of love, and of solidarity. But the reason why this doesn't exist, in my opinion, is because it exists as an online movement. And on the internet perspective, there's no room for charity, because if you're charitable, you get fucked. Excuse me for using the foul language, but it's true. And so I think that, you know, Heimbach, one of the great things that you do is, you know, you actualize this in the real world. And it's much, much more easy to be charitable with somebody when you stand shoulder to shoulder with him in a picket line.
Well, exactly. And, you know, that's actually, you know, one of the reasons why we use the term comrade in the Traditionalist Worker Party. And the idea, I mean, the NSDAP used it, the British Union of Fascists used it, it's been well used. Of course, everyone thinks of the Soviet Union and Cold War propaganda, but it was used traditionally by the right for a lot of reasons. And one of the big reasons is, no matter who you are a comrade. You know, I am the chairman of the party, but I am everyone's comrade. If you just joined the party today, you literally just hit the sign-up button as you're listening to this podcast, you are my comrade, the same as someone who has been here since the very beginning, one of the old fighters, back at the White Student Union, you know? And that, we really, one of the reasons we picked that term is not just the historical purpose, but because of that principle, that we are comrades, that we are in a shared struggle with one another, that we are, you know, forced to rely on one another, and we should rely on one another, and that we are an extended family. The entire idea of nationalism is taking care of your extended family. And ideologically, I think one of the big problems is, I mean, I was on the Ron Paul campaign as a volunteer in 2012. A lot of us come from libertarianism, but a lot of us are still stuck in libertarianism or anarcho-capitalism or things like that. And if we've got ideologies in our movement that are individualist at its very core, there is no way to take a radical individualist and have him have a collective responsibility and duty to his fellow kinsmen, the men and women that he has this responsibility and duty to fight for. So do you think, I mean, not to talk about infighting and then talk about maybe a need for infighting, but do you see a way moving forward that radical individualist ideologies can really have a seat at the table, because they do seem diametrically opposed to that charitable and collective spirit and responsibility that we have for one another?
No, frankly, I do not, and neither do I see any place at the table for any sort of non-idealist or materialist philosophy. I think that these things are fundamentally opposed to everything that we stand for, and this is what I'm talking about when I say the worldview, or the fascist worldview, is, you know, you have to fundamentally think and process information and live in a similar way to everyone else. And if you're like an individual materialist, there is no way that you're going to be able to do that, because you live in a completely different world than we do. You process every piece of information through a different lens than we do. Your decisions are made in a fundamentally different manner. And so this is what I'm talking about, where, you know, we need to be pure in terms of our worldview, but diverse in terms of the actualization. And I think this is the golden mean. And so rather than purity spiraling, or, you know, I hate this term, but, or moralizing on these, you know, like little nuances, or, you know, does this guy do that? This guy do whatever? What's this guy's past? Well, we need to be firm on the core of the worldview, which is, as you say, you know, nationalism, and that, you know, non-Marxian socialism solidarity, that we stand first for others. And that's the core,
well, exactly,
of it, I think.
It's faith, family, and folk. I mean, that really is the, you know, when we were coming up with the motto of TWP, and, you know, not to pat ourselves on the back, but it was like, what are the core? What is the core of what we need to be able to save our people, to defeat the kikes, as you said, and to be able to make sure that our kids, we build a future, we build a land where they will be safe, where they'll be able to have a healthy morality, healthy families, and our blood and our culture will survive. And it boils down to faith, family, and folk. Those things are so interconnected with one another, we can't transcend that. So that, I mean, I agree with you, because the thing is about radical materialism, the kikes will always be able to pay more money. Like Sir Oswald Mosley said, I can't offer you anything but struggle. And that's true to all my listeners. I or Florian or Sven or anyone else, we can only offer you struggle in this cause. And if you're doing this for material reasons or ego or personal benefit, the Jews will always be able to offer you more money. They'll always be able to get you on TV and talk about how great you are more than this. But what we're fighting for is deeper than that. It is true. And it's what we need to be able to win this battle. So, Florian, I guess a question for you. We're coming to the end of the show. We need to do this more often. I love it. Give a final thought to our listeners to carry them into the weekend. Hit them with something deep.
And with something deep. Wow, that's a tall order. But I guess I would say, going back to spiritual warfare, Julius Evola, his Metaphysics of War, which is a fantastic book, which everybody should read, talks about how first it was considered by all traditional societies that you conquer on the spiritual plane and then actualize it on the material plane. So fundamentally, our struggle, as we mentioned before, is not against flesh and blood, but against principality and powers. And the only way that we can actually defeat these kikes, as Adolf Hitler said, is with a new, more powerful, more radical idea. Well, I'm probably butchering that. So the only way in which we can actually get this dynamic energy, which will enable us to achieve the final victory that we're looking for, is if we fully embrace the spiritual struggle. And the first place that starts is within ourselves. We're all sinful creatures. We all have our faults and flaws. Many of us, including ourselves, come out of degeneracy and have, you know, are recovering from the scars of a childhood spent in this postmodernist wasteland. And so what we need to do is we need to, first, if we want to defeat our enemies without, look towards our enemies within and fight our passions. So the best way to do this, look at yourself, pick your most egregious flaw, and fight it aggressively.
Well, I absolutely 100% agree with that. Florian Geyer, thank you so much for being here, and I'm going to look forward to being on a show with you tomorrow, actually. So everyone tune in. I look forward to sharing that link. And thank you to all my listeners. This has been an amazing week. We're going to be continuing this discussion, hopefully, when Florian has time to join us again. And I'm going to look forward to being here on Monday with another edition of The Daily Traditionalist. Thank you guys so much. Thank you again, Florian. Thank you, Sven, for all the tech work you do. And I look forward to seeing you guys on the end of the weekend. So have a great day, and hail victory!
Be tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArea.com.